Hi, everybody. This is Jack Urbont, writer of the Marvel superhero theme songs. I've written superhero sing-alongs about defeating evil and overcoming strife. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey everyone, welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber. Incredibly entertaining show in store for you today. In just a few moments, I'm going to be welcoming legendary songwriter Jack Urbont. Jack wrote the Marvel superheroes theme songs for the 1960s cartoons. They premiered 50 years ago, September 1st. Huge anniversary. Man, a lot of things happened in 1966. We're going to be chatting about his career and his time in the Marvel Universe in just a few minutes. Before we get to that, I want to mention the incredible time I had at Terrificon in Uncasville, Connecticut this past weekend. Once again, I took the show on the road, met up with some fellow nerds. That was fun. Moderated a bunch of Q&A sessions. Gotham's Cameron B. Condova, she plays Selina Kyle on the show. Ren and Stimpy's Bob Camp, that was fun. Spider-Man and his amazing friends Rick Hoberg. Friends of the show, John Wesley Shipp from The Flash, Sam Jones, Flash Gordon, caught up with them again. You're going to hear those Q&As in the weeks ahead. Also chatted with Sean Gunn from Guardians of the Galaxy, writer Peter David, friend of the show, Star Trek's Rene Auberjonois, AMC's The Comic Book Man. Man, met a lot of people there. More surprises are on the way, all coming up in the next few weeks right here on Comic Book Central. Also made a few contacts for some upcoming in-depth interviews as well. So those are going to be coming your way in the months, weeks and months ahead, in fact. Amazing job from Terrificon creator and my fellow podcaster on the IndieCast, Mitch Halleck. His crew, all of the volunteers there, incredible job. Everyone at the Mohegan Sun, that is an amazing place for a convention. Huge facility, but a very intimate show all at the same time. So I really can't tell you how much fun I had. You're going to hear it. And if you're on the Facebook page, you can see a lot of it. Man, if you were there, you know how cool it was. Honestly, where else are you going to get to see Arrow's Katrina Law having a dance party with her fans and a full-scale Hulkbuster? Nowhere else but Terrificon, I say. All right, here's the deal. Like Comic Book Central on Facebook. I'm posting all kinds of links to videos that people are shooting from Terrificon. A lot of the Q&As, some of my full Q&As are going to be up there as well. So those are going to be coming up in the weeks ahead. I'll post those. Multiple episodes of Comic Book Central coming your way in the weeks ahead. You're going to get them all if you stream them on the website. It's comicbookcentral.net. We're on Blueberry as well. Or subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher. Then not only are you going to get the upcoming episodes and won't miss a moment of the fun that's headed your way, but you're going to get all of the past episodes that you might have missed as well. Follow the show on Twitter at comicbookctrl, then you are in the know as well. Hashtag share the lair. Get this out to your friends and family. Retweet the shows when they post on Saturday on Twitter. Share the episodes on Facebook. Help me reach that bigger audience. You can also support the show by leaving a review in iTunes. For those of you who've done that, thank you so much for that. It just takes seconds. Really appreciate it when you do that. All right. As I mentioned, big show on tap today. A lot of musical memories are in store. Let's get a little background on my special guest. Then the legendary lyricist will be in the lair, Jack Urbont. Jack Urbont grew up with a showbiz background. His father worked on Broadway and broadcasting, and young Jack became an actor at an early age. He eventually became a songwriter, making music from coast to coast on Broadway, just like his father, and writing numerous themes and musical compositions for television shows in Hollywood, including Mission Impossible, Mannix, and General Hospital. He's been nominated for multiple Emmys and scored the prize for Lauren Green's New Wilderness. He's even worked with some of the biggest names in the biz, Julie Andrews, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Sammy Davis Jr., so many others. But 50 years ago, he became part of the universe we comic fans all know and love, the Marvel Universe. In 1966, some of Marvel's heaviest hitters were brought off the pages of the comics to animated life. quite literally, in fact, as the production company used the original artwork and stories from the comic books for the series. Now, while the animation itself was pretty basic, not to say the least, the music was quite the opposite. Catchy, memorable tunes. Jack was brought on to write the overall theme for the heroes. As well as the individual characters, Prince Namor the Submariner.
Stronger than a whale, he can swim anywhere.
He can breathe underwater and go flying through the air.
The mighty Thor.
Across the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar.
The incredible Hulk.
Bruce Banner, melted by gamma rays, turned into the Hulk.
Ain't he on gamma rays?
Captain America.
When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield must yield.
And the invincible Iron Man.
Tony Stark makes you feel he's a cool exec with a heart of steel.
Now with these cartoons, the Marvel characters were brought to life on television for the first time. Will we ever see an official release of these classic cartoons on Blu-ray? No idea as of yet, but what we do know is that 50 years later, we're still loving them, and Jack Arbon is still making international headlines for his time in the Marvel Universe, as we will discuss. Well, my guest today is an Emmy Award-winning composer who has worked on some of our favorite television music, including the tunes that backed up the super adventures of the Marvel superheroes back in the 60s. A big welcome to Jack Arbon. Mr. Arbon, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you, Mr. Stuver. I appreciate that. Not only was it the music, it was also the lyrics, which I'm quite proud of.
Well, okay, that's going to lead me into my first question. But first of all, I want to thank you very much for the rhyme, the lyrics that you penned off the start off the show. I'm honored to have something written for Comic Book Central by the great Jack Arbon. you know, we mentioned songwriter, we mentioned writer, we mentioned composer. Okay, so for those of us who are not musically inclined, what's the difference between songwriter, composer? Is there a difference between the two? Do they kind of overlap? How do you see it?
Actually, they do both.
Okay.
There is a difference, and they overlap, and they are distinct. There have been, throughout the history of film music, a small number of composers who have had a melodic gift, as well as being excellent scorers, orchestrator scorers, you see? And those are two kind of separate gifts, but when they converge, they're the height of the art. For instance, Tchaikovsky was a great melodist and a great symphony writer. Beethoven could write a great tune as well as do great constructs. Bronislaw Kaper, who wrote San Francisco, la-da-da-da-da, remember that song?
Exactly.
Okay, he was an excellent songwriter and a fine film scorer. Max Steiner was also a fine melodist as well as a fine film scorer. John Williams can write a fine melody, not a really great song, but a fine melody, and is a wonderful scorer. And on the other hand, there have been other composers, I won't mention the names because I don't want to disparage anybody, who are...
We're all about keeping it nice and friendly on Comic Book Central.
But they are excellent scorers, but they can't write a decent tune.
Okay.
So... In my case, my first drive toward music came about due to my father, and that's how I became a melodist and a lyricist. What I mean to say is my father was one of the busiest concertmasters in New York.
Your father was on Broadway at the time. Take us back into that world a little bit. How old were you when you kind of knew what he was doing? What exactly was he doing? And how did that spark your interest?
Well, I knew what he was doing because to achieve peace in our house, in our apartment, he would lock himself into the bathroom to practice every day.
Did you just have one bathroom in the house?
In those days, we had one bathroom. I grew up in Sunnyside.
Well, okay, that had to make it tough if Dad's in there practicing and someone's got to use the facilities.
That's true. That's true. And that was the only time he was interrupted. And believe me, he never played Handel's Water Music. But I grew up.
You paint an interesting picture. Not, yeah, not only you a lyricist, but you paint an interesting picture.
There's a sound picture for you.
Exactly.
So I knew he was a violinist. It was happening in the house. My mother was an excellent pianist, Dorothy. She was a graduate of Peabody in Baltimore, Peabody Conservatory, and she was a fine coloratura soprano. So there was always music going on in my house. My sister had a heck of a good voice, Toby, and was a fine artist. And so I grew up in that milieu where there was music going on all the time. On the other hand, music, which I used to fool around with and drive piano teachers nuts, because I had a very good ear. So when they would give me a piece to play, I would play it by ear, you know, when I could replicate the piece once I heard it. But of course, I'd never play it exactly as written. Consequently, I became a terrible reader of music and an excellent player of music.
Okay, because that's my uncle was the same way. He learned guitar by ear, so he didn't read sheet music, but he would like listen to albums. He would listen to Beatles albums and just play and mimic what he heard. So you're in the same zone as that. Yeah. Okay.
We're in good company because there have been some terrific composers such as Charlie Chaplin, who could not read music, but could write beautiful melodies. You know, of course, Irving Berlin couldn't read music and was one of our greatest songwriters.
Oh, wow.
So I
didn't know either of those things.
Yeah. And Berlin could only play on the black keys of the piano, and he was a heck of a pianist on those black keys. And when he had to rehearse with a singer, of course, not every singer could sing in the black key areas, you know. So he had a piano where he could move a lever, and he could still play in the black keys, but the lever would cause the music on the piano to come out in the key of the singer he was rehearsing with. There were a few of those pianos in existence. I think one is in the Library of Congress. Your question was how I started. My father used to do Broadway shows, and in that era, that was the era which, to answer your question, when did I start? I really started around eight years of old age. Outside of just frustrating a lot of piano teachers, I used to improvise skits with my sister, and my father did the, among many other shows, he did the Eddie Cantor show. He also did the Fred Allen show, Mr. District Attorney, many, many radio shows, because that was, as I say, that was what existed in those eras. Mm-hmm. So on Wednesday afternoons, my father would invite my mother, my sister, and I to Studio 8H at NBC, where we'd sit in the balcony and watch a rehearsal of the Eddie Cantor show. Eddie Cantor would leap up and down the stage singing, "If you do, Susie, like I know Susie, oh, 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 what a gal," that sort of thing, and wave a handkerchief, and I thought, my, that's great, I want to do that, you know, in my little eight-year-old brain. So I made enough noise, and my folks started my sister and I in acting school. At any rate, at about 10 years of age, I started acting on WNYC, gratis, with a lot of other very good actors, and shortly thereafter, I did an audition for NBC. My drama teacher said Jackie doesn't want to memorize anything, but he's really got a natural flair. And her husband, a fellow named Gil Mack, who was a fine character actor, wrote me some audition material. That's the material I used at NBC and other places. And I passed with flying colors. And as a result, I started doing radio shows. In fact, I have my very first check. On the check, it is dated 1941. From Young and Rubicam Advertising for $106 to Jackie Urbont.
You didn't cash it?
Oh, I cashed it, but this is a...
They got the Xerox back. Okay, got it.
Yeah, in those days it wasn't called Xerox.
Say $106, you better cash that back in the day.
That was good money in those days. Course, you know?
Good money now, I'll take $106.
Right, exactly.
Well, what were you doing at 10? So you're going and performing. What are you doing at 10 years old?
I was doing radio shows.
Right, but what, like, were you doing voices? Were you singing? Well, were you playing?
No, I was acting. We'd get a script, mm-hmm. and I'd read the lines, you know, act the lines.
Do you remember what kind of characters you were doing, or what kind of
kids?
Plays?
Usually played kids.
Okay.
I played, kids, people my age.
Okay.
I did the Molly Picon show. I still have a recording of that with a lot of cracks in it.
Oh, wow.
On glass. I did so many shows. I did the Goldbergs when it was a radio show. The Goldbergs on CBS was the first sitcom, by the way. It is historically known as the first sitcom. I Remember Mama, The March of Time, God, Mr. District Attorney. There were so many of them. I can't even memorize them all.
Okay.
You know?
And then did you segue that into cartoon voice acting? Because I saw some things about like maybe Little Lulu cartoons and Popeye cartoons.
Yes. I did what in those days was called trick voices. Trick voices then became cartoon voices, and now they're called toon voices. You know,
okay.
But trick voices
meant that I could speak in all kinds of funny voices.
you know what I mean, don't you? So I would not only play kids, but I would do these kooky characters for the cartoons.
Oh, okay. So you're just kind of like a great utility performer coming in and just knocking a bunch of things out for them.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I got to be known for doing that, and I had quite a resume built up. But while I was doing that, my father brought me to the rehearsals of the number of shows, Broadway shows that he did. Perhaps I should preface this by just including one or two stories about Harry and his remarkable career.
Yeah, please.
When he was a kid of in his young 20s, he received a call from a friend of his who said, "Harry, can you play sad music?" He said, "Of course." He said, "Why are you asking?" He says, "Well, there's a film studio not too far from where you live in the Bronx, and they need someone to play sad music for the actors." He says, "Okay, well, give me the address." He went down, and the actors were Lionel Barrymore and Lillian Gish.
Oh, my.
and the director was, believe it or not, hold on to your hat, D.W. Griffith.
Let me go get a hat. I'm going to hold on to it.
And the
man.
And the cameraman.
Nice gig.
Was Billy Bitzer. These people, D.W. Griffith and Billy Bitzer, created film history.
Yeah, nice gig.
So I'm just saying my father's career had any number of these stories, like the time he was playing in a studio owned by Thomas Edison. And Thomas Edison came in, and he loved to chew tobacco, and he spit into a spittoon. And the tone that it came out of the spittoon when the spit hit the spittoon, was, my father says, "Hey, that's amazing. We're playing in that same key."
The key of Spittoon.
Yes, the key of the Spittoon. So anyway, Harry invited me to a number, every time he did a Broadway show. Oh, I really got to tell you this story. He gets another call from a guy named Saul Guzikoff, who became a very well-known Broadway contractor. Guzikoff says, "Harry, I got a job for you." Harry says, "I can't do it." He says, "Why not?" He says, "It's a show." My father says, "I can't do it." "But why? Why?" He says, "I'm practicing for my recital." He says, "So practice during the day and play the show at night." I says, "Oh, okay." Well, the show was by two unknown songwriters named Rogers and Hart.
I think we may have heard of them.
You may have heard of them. And as it turned out, Dick Rogers and my father were the identical age. At that point, they were 25 years old. And Rogers was about to give up. That show caused Rogers to remain in show business. It was Garrick Gaieties, which he did with Hart for nothing for the Theater Guild, you know, and then it, as a benefit. And then the show became so popular, it became a literal show that the Theater Guild put on. So at any rate, Dick Rogers and my father became good friends, and everything that Rogers did, Harry was always called in as concertmaster, and whenever Harry was free, he did it. So when Rogers did By Jupiter, that show with Larry Hart, starring Ray Bolger, Harry invites me down, I hear it, I hear these wonderful songs coming out, and that influenced me. You know, I'm a kid, 9 years old, listening to this stuff. Wow. And then when Harry did Panama Hattie, Cole Porter wrote that. And by the way, I met Rogers then when I was a kid. And I met Cole Porter when I was a kid. And I'm hearing these songs. One of my favorite songs of that show, Panama Hattie, is What Say let's be buddies. What say, let's be pals. What say, let's be buddies and keep up each other's morales. Ethel Merman sang it. At any rate, I'm not going to do the whole song for you because I'm sure that'll turn you off.
No, I could do I could do a whole separate episode of just Jack Urban sings. We can do a part two. We'll release it as a CD. Well, a live CD.
Well, that'll be sure to turn off your audience.
Oh, no. They'll be tuning in for that. Okay, so you're coming in. So massive Hollywood background. Yeah.
Well, what I was getting at was that by hearing these shows by these great songwriters, that influenced me to start writing songs. And that's what I did. I started my first complete song. I was writing melodies at the piano, but my first music and lyrics was for someone I fell in love with when I was 12.
Wow.
In Baltimore. And wrote a song called Think of Me. I'm not going to bother singing it for you, but
I was curious, what styles did you gravitate toward? Were there certain, you know, was it swing? Was it jazz?
It was show.
Was it show tunes?
Show style.
Okay.
Show tunes, because that's what influenced me. Beautiful melodies, you know, the ones that would become popular, and perky melodies as well. I mean, basically what I called show tunes, but which were all very melodic. And that actually became a keynote of my career. And one of the reasons, for instance, my General Hospital theme is on the air for 40 years is because it is at its heart a show tune. Mm. It is a melody that stands up. So I became a melodist. And that relates back to your question about scorers, people who are composers. Composers can do anything musically. You know, they can create an elephant out of sound. And the ones who are fine melodists can do both, which is the height of, as I had mentioned before.
So what were some of the early things getting into musically? I mean, I saw Sherry Lewis's show. So were you composing music, starting to come into that era of just kind of working in television themes and television background music and things like that?
My first paying television show was Sherry Lewis, writing songs. For Lamb Chop and Charlie Horse.
I was going to ask you, Lamb Chop give you any troubles?
No, but Charlie Horse bit me. He kicked me in the ass, too. But I still remember one of those songs that I wrote for Sherry. Me and my crystal ball are lucky as we can be, 'cause we know what the world is coming to. What do you think we see? Lollipop days, happy and free. That's what the big old world is coming to, and it's coming to you and me. It goes on if you want to hear the rest.
I'm telling you, I'm doing a part two with this. You and I are going to do a live concert. This is going to, we are time tripping today. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. No, it's just these, I mean, well, and we'll talk about some of these other ones as we go through, but you have such a knack for a turn of a phrase and just doing, man, just these memorable tunes that kind of get into our head, get into our DNA. Look, we've been talking a lot about 1966 here on Comic Book Central, 50th anniversary for so many pop culture hit shows. I spoke with Herb Solo about his time at Desilu with Star Trek, Mission Impossible, Mannix. Mm-hmm. You kind of cross over into that world as well, too, don't you? We'll talk about the Marvel stuff here in a second, because that's also in 1966. You had a huge year in 1966.
Well, Marvel actually collided with Mission Impossible, if you want to know the truth.
Yeah, let's talk about the Desilu stuff, and then you kind of segue it into the Marvel stuff for us.
Okay, well, the Desilu, I wrote a little teeny little lyric for you for Desilu. Because it has to do with Mission Impossible.
You did right. This is an original Jack Urban composition, right?
Right.
Okay. We've got to get you. We've got to get your little portable keyboard hooked up at some point. But yeah, go for it. This is going
to
be cool.
Okay. A precise slice of the lives, the ascents to the skies and dives to the cellar of Jack Urban, Bruce Geller, and Mission Impossible. That's what's coming up. Out these stories will pour. That's what's in store. And if time permits, even more.
Definitely even more. We're going to be talking about a lot more. Oh, mm-hmm. My goodness, the great Bruce Geller. Yeah, coming in with Mission Impossible. And yeah, let's talk about some of the music, some of the things that we've heard that we may have heard when we watched the show, and your time at Desilu and Herb Solo. Yeah, go ahead and walk us through
sure.
that.
Sure. Well, first I've got to tell you that I to tell you about Desilu, I must tell you about how Bruce Geller and I had met. While I was at college, Queens College, a couple of my friends there had gone to Brandeis, a camp in the Santa Susana Mountains of California. It was a Jewish cultural camp, so obviously most of these guys were Jews. And since I was a Jew,
that wouldn't make sense.
That made sense, right?
Yeah, of course.
But they were very musical. And so I was introduced to the guy who was running the music department there, and he offered me a scholarship. So my father drove us out to California, my whole family and I, and I spent a summer at Brandeis. And as one would know it, I wrote, of course, the closing show, the camp show, with a lot of funny songs. And one of the songs was a song I had written for one of my girlfriends, when I was about 15. It's called My Love for You. And I included it in the show, and we went, when I say we, I mean...
Apparently music got you a lot of dates, too, didn't it?
Hey, man, let me give you a parenthetical story. Let me give you
now I know why you got into music. Give me a break.
Now you know it. Hey, watch out for those piano players. They get into more than keyboards. The fact of the matter is that I wrote a song for a girl. I don't see why I shouldn't mention her name. Her name was Toni. And I was nuts about her. She was my first serious girlfriend. I was probably 16. Oh, Toni, baby, you are the one who fills my daydreams until the setting sun, and when the shadows of eve descend, I find my daydreams don't seem to end. They are glowing with a fire. Won't you quell the surging swell of my desire? Oh, baby Toni, you'll always see that life's sweet joys were fated for you. Love was created for you. You'll always be, Toni, baby, the one for me. So,
no way she could resist that.
So there was that song.
You know what's funny? I talked to Ron Dante from the Archies, and he said he would always try to incorporate the word baby into songs. There seems to be a theme I'm catching on here with you musicians.
Yeah.
Just work
right.
The word baby in and you're gold.
Yes. So when Toni and I broke up, I was going with a girl named Gladys, I'd sing to her, "Oh, Gladys, baby, you are the one." And when it became... when it became Jenny, oh, Jenny, baby. You'd be amazed at how many girlfriends that song got me.
Oh, you're a con artist. You're a romantic con artist.
I'm a musical con artist. Exactly.
We're on to you now. You didn't sing that to Bruce. You didn't sing Bruce Geller, baby, did you?
Well, guess what? Now, let's cut to New York. Oh, I'd say about a year and a half later. I'm crossing the street. I'm still at Princeton. I'm crossing 57th Street, and lo and behold, who is coming towards me, pregnant, out to Staten Island? Ginny Marks. I said, "Ginny, I hope you're married." She said, "Yes, I married a writer," and we'd start talking. So I said, "Well, why don't you and your husband come to see my show? It'll be tomorrow night at the Henry Hudson Hotel." So they did. They came to see the show. And after the show, we take a walk to get some coffee. As we're walking along 57th Street, Bruce sings me My Love for You. Well, I could have dropped my pants.
I hope you didn't.
I didn't. I held on to my belt buckle. And we had coffee, and he said, "You know, I'm looking for a composer, and you write such memorable melodies. I'd like you to look at this script." So I looked at this script. It was based on Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, and I had a lot of charm to it. I said, "Yeah, Bruce, I'll do it." That was our first musical. I'm giving you this background because it all is going to lead to Desilu. Desilu was going into production. They needed projects, and Bruce's agent, Alden Schwimmer, said, "We got to get him something quick." So Bruce took this film script he could not sell and refashioned it as a TV idea. I couldn't do it because I had these two Broadway shows, and I was talking with Bob Lawrence about doing the Marvel superheroes. All of that stuff was colliding, you know.
Yeah.
And going
and just
into,
for our listeners, so they know, I mean, we've got the great Mission Impossible theme by Lalo Schifrin.
Right.
That's coming
Absolutely.
In. So they're coming in. So you're going, kind of doing the thematic music for episodes or certain episodes that are coming in.
Yes, I became a team of there was a team of excellent composers. Walter Scharf, I mean, who did Funny Girl. There were about, I don't know, probably about four or five of us who were excellent. Yeah. Of course, not one guy could do it all.
Oh, because they're cracking these episodes out like crazy. I mean, the production time on these is so short.
Yeah.
And they needed hit shows on the air right then. Herb was telling us, you know, that they were just cranking these things out so fast.
They were, yeah. And that's where I met Herb Solo. But before that, I told Bruce, he said, when do you need me? He said, yesterday. I said, Bruce, I'm wrapped up with two Broadway shows, and I got a TV thing that might become real, and I'm going to go to Europe to record the stuff, you know, all of the scores, and put the voices in, probably in Toronto.
And this is the Marvel Superheroes.
That's right. So
yeah.
I'm just saying, I had actually four projects. There was another one. They were all colliding. And at any rate, he said, well, if the show sells, then come out in the fall, you know, when we'll be doing the episodes, shooting the episodes, and you'll score it. I said, you got it. So I did go out. I did actually orchestrate the theme for I'll tell you about the theme in a second, Lalo's theme. I orchestrated the theme for a library session that was used throughout the show, and another theme that Lalo had written called da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which was used, that piece of music was used when Peter Lupus was doing, you know, lifting things, or they were trying to break into things. And here is a couple of interesting factors about Mission Impossible. It was originally scheduled as a half-hour show. Bruce's competition to get on the air was Robert Altman. It was a toss-up between Mission Impossible pilot and the Robert Altman pilot, and Paley and company chose the Mission Impossible. As a result, they had to change the time length of the show from a half hour to an hour. So Bruce expanded it to an hour. How did he do it? He had the good guys tinkering around with building little things, and he got that idea from a film called Rafifi, which had about an 18-minute segment with no dialogue where they were breaking into a bank. So Bruce figured...
Musical beds.
Well, yeah, exactly. Musical bed. And he figured if it worked in Rafifi, why can't it work here with my show?
That's,
you know,
right, especially when you're cranking out that many episodes a year. Yeah,
right.
I was kind of, you know, I was kind of wondering too, because I knew this was going on in California, but then I also knew this meeting that you took in New York, because that's where Marvel was at the time. So, I mean, so tell me about this experience you had with Marvel. How did you find out about the animated project that they were producing first, and then we'll go into the meeting that you had?
Well, I had a friend named Larry Coleman, who was a lyricist on a song that was quite popular in the 60s. I don't want a ricochet romance. I don't want a ricochet love. And so Larry Coleman was working for an excellent publisher, Howie Richmond. Howie published Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, among other things. He was a fine guy. And they set up a meeting with Stan Lee and another fellow. I don't remember his name. Larry and Howie Richmond. And
so, I mean, how did your friend approach you? Like, well, I mean, cause you don't have a comic book background, or at least with the Marvel characters that are going. So how did he approach you? What was the pitch that initially interested you?
Larry knew I was writing for Sherry Lewis.
Okay.
And this was going to be, and by the way, they had no film. They had no nothing. They, not only that, they were fighting among themselves. I mean, I'm talking about all the principals among themselves. I'm not talking about Marvel, because Marvel was a small player, believe it or not. At the time, was a teeny tiny player. It wasn't the monster, great production outfit that it is today. And the principals, when I say the principals, I'm talking about Bob Lawrence, Grant Ray, a guy named Hal Grant.
The production company that was going to be taking on this animated project.
Exactly. Right. And it was not Marvel that was the production company.
Yeah, they, because we talked to Stan Lee, you know, early on. That was actually one of my first, that was actually my first episode where he talked about, at the time, they were kind of farming all these things out to
exactly.
other companies, where they eventually, in the 80s, kind of started doing their own thing.
Exactly. Yeah. They had absolutely nothing to do with the production.
He was just happy they were using his stories, and we get the great Kirby art. But, I mean, you're kind of coming into this cold. So you're writing for a children's show. Your friend knew that was the appeal and that you might be a fit for this.
Yeah, he knew my background.
Right.
He knew
but did he say was... comic books to you? Did you
no.
know what this
no.
was going
on? No, he said there are some people who are trying to put together a TV show.
That was it.
That was it. I didn't know. I had no idea what it was about.
You didn't know Incredible Hulk, Captain America. You didn't know any of this stuff.
Nothing.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, so
absolutely.
You're just taking a meeting. It's a gig. You're taking a meeting. Why
I'm
not?
I'm going to look at the possible as a possibility of a potential job.
Love it. Love
and,
it. History. And, I love just these little nuggets of history that come in where they just start as, yeah, whatever. I'll just go into it. So you get a meeting with, among others, Stan Lee.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And
Did you even know who Stan Lee was?
No.
Okay. And again, this is 1965, I'm thinking. So, yeah, kind of in the infancy.
Yeah,
if you're into comic books, then you know.
I think it was 66, actually.
Okay.
And Stan, I believe at the time, was the assistant to Jack Kirby. And he, you know, who was a great creator of these comic book characters and an artist. And Stan's uncle was the fellow who had this teeny tiny, he had about five little publishing companies and this comic book company, which I can't remember the name.
It began with Timely originally. Yeah.
Timely Comics or something. Yeah. Right. It wasn't even Marvel to begin with. And Stan, you know, came down as a representative of his uncle who, you know, had the, these characters that he was developing into comic book stories. And, so Stan, as you, I may have told you, did say, Jack, I assume you know our comic book heroes. And I said, no, I don't. and he said, well, I'm sure you've read the comic books. I said, no, I haven't. So he looks at Howie Richman as if to say, why the hell did you bring this guy to me? I said, Mr. Lee, I said, I'm reading the expression on your face. And believe me, if I were in your shoes, I'd have the same expression. I said, if you get me a couple of comic books and any source material you want to throw at me, give me a few days, and I will come back with songs so terrific that you'll wish you had written it yourself. And the
irony—pretty bold to say that to Stan Lee, even at the time, too.
I want you to tell you, man, I had. You know, bigger than a balloon.
Well, be friendly.
Bigger than a dirigible.
You had guts, let's say.
I had guts. I was a kid actor, you know. When you're an actor, you got to have guts. You know, after all, you come in and you're auditioning against a million people and, you know.
Okay, I'm assuming they gave you, like, the origin issues. Because you said you got a few comics to read over. I'm assuming these were kind of like the origin issues of Iron Man and Captain America.
I have
America.
No idea.
Did you keep them?
No, I didn't keep them. I had no idea. I'm sorry I didn't, believe me. I'm sorry I was not an aficionado of comic books, now that I know how much they're worth.
Oh.
But the fact is that the irony about my comment to Stan, you know, it'll be so fine that you'll wish you had written them yourself, was that many years later, and I have this article that Sam put in a magazine where he said Urban's songs were so brilliant, I wish I'd written them myself.
Oh man, that is the highest praise. That is the highest praise from Stan Lee.
Yeah, and he's a fine fella, and a fine writer, who really, in his heart of hearts, would have loved to have been a novelist.
Yeah, he said he wanted to write the great American novel, and he ended up, changing history. creating a whole new universe. Yeah, it's amazing how things happen.
And what's amazing is he's in his 90s and he's going strong.
It's unbelievable. It's amazing how you talk to, you know, yourself and Stan Lee, and it's just like, I think he hit upon it is that he's doing what he likes to do. It doesn't seem like work to him, and I think you're doing the same thing, and I think that keeps you young, at least from the perspective I get from it.
I think so. I think doing what you like to do, and also very significantly, is you've got to keep your body moving.
Yeah.
At very minimum, you've got to walk.
Yeah, which I'm sure you guys do. You're probably running from place to place. So you take
for my creditors.
You're running for your life.
Yeah, I'm running for my life.
All right, so you get these comic books, you take them back, and this is your first experience in the world of Marvel superheroes.
Yeah.
What did you see in those comic books? We'll go through the different themes, and you kind of take me through thematically. But just as an overall view, what were you seeing in the comic books? What were your takeaways?
Well, just basically, I just read a couple of the comic books, and I got the idea of what these I got the idea that Hulk was someone who got when he got disturbed, he just turned into a what they used to call a monster clown. That was an expression that I remember they used in the comic books, and Thor would use his mighty hammer, and and he was from Asgard, and therefore I picked up facts about these characters. So when it came time to writing a lyric, I knew what to do. Now, I will tell you this, one of the best lyrics I've ever written, and may I be so bold as to say, perhaps one of the best lyrics ever written.
May I guess?
Pardon me?
May I guess?
Yes.
I think you're probably, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're probably the only lyricist who's ever rhymed gamma rays with unglamorous.
Unglamorous.
Yes. Is that the one you were going for?
No, but okay. that is, I do like,
that's my favorite.
I don't just like writing, I don't like rhyming cloud with loud. I like to make complex rhymes that rhyme with each other. And what I did with Captain America is did something that has extremely rarely been done, in lyrics, and never been done in poetry, which is, I'll do it for you. Yep. When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield must yield. If he's led to a fight and a duel is due, then the red and the white and the blue will come through when Captain America throws his mighty shield. Well, that line, if he's led to a fight and a duel is due, then the red and the white and the blue will come through. Having every stressed syllable of one line rhyme with every stressed syllable of the next line has never been done.
Wow. I wouldn't have even put that together.
It has been done where certain words in one line, our phrases have rhymed with phrases, but never where the whole line, rhymes. So I'm very, very proud of that, and hardly anybody, of course, is aware of it, because after all.
Well, what made you think in those terms for that then? Since you're so outside of what is typically done with that.
Very simply, I'm a musician and a composer, so I have a musical ear. So I'm not just hearing a rhyme, as I said, as I mentioned with loud and cloud. Yeah. I'm hearing couplets of rhymes and whole sentences that rhyme. I have a musical ear, and I was writing, stuff from a very early age. Not that I'm trying to say that I'm William Shakespeare or as great as some of the very great people who've made tremendous contributions like Irving Berlin, but I have my little notable piece of contribution to popular culture, and in that little contribution that I've made, I'm quite proud of it. And as I mentioned, you take Captain America, often quite original. With Mission Impossible, I had an attitude toward my work, which is, as Bruce, I wish he were here to confirm this, I told Bruce, I'm not just going to write background music to an episode. I'm going to write background music to the key aspect of the episode, and that key aspect is going to thread itself throughout the whole episode, such as in the Short Tail Spy episode, where Barbara Bain fell in love with a spy, an actor named Hans Gudegist. And Hans, by the way, went on to do soap operas of which I wrote background music and themes.
The great Eric Braden.
Yeah, yeah. So Hans,
friend of the
Hans
show. Yeah, we got to chat some sci-fi movies with him right here on the show.
You're amazing.
You've got your Hollywood stories. I'll get my Hollywood stories.
Right. I got to interview you. So,
well, I mean, yeah, so you're actually bringing, I mean, you're, the music isn't just the underlying thing. You're actually, it almost becomes a character in itself then.
Exactly. So with The Short Tail Spy, in that show, I said, Bruce, here we got Bob Rabane falling in love with this guy. He's nuts about her, and this compromises his whole mission. I said, let us use The Lady Was Made to Be Loved from our show, All in Love. Let's use it as the keynote piece of music throughout the episode. So that's what was done. And by the way, the Mission Impossible office screwed up and gave the credit to some other composer. Someone made
serious?
A typo. Yeah.
You got paid, though, didn't you?
No, to this day, I've been screwed on the royalties.
Oh, man.
Yes.
There's really another lawsuit coming up. We'll talk about it.
Quite exasperating.
Oh, again, that's showbiz. The themes are kind of becoming the characters, and we certainly see that, I mean, in a huge way with the Marvel superheroes. I mean, those are the things that are identified with it. Take us through the process, too, because you mentioned about going to Europe. You mentioned about Toronto. So this is, take us through that triangulation of New York, Europe, and Toronto. I'm just putting all this together.
Okay, sure. I had the good fortune of knowing Harold Orenstein, who was Frank Lesser's attorney. And Harold also was connected with BMI. And Harold used to say to me, Jack, if you're working for a big company and they're paying you decently, he said, you go with the flow. If you're working with people who are underpaying you, then control all the rights. And I listened to his words, and that's what I did. When I worked for people who were like, the football project that I have that was underpaying me, I controlled all the rights. On the Marvel superheroes, I was vastly underpaid, but I would have paid them to get, I never said that, but I would have paid them to get my stuff on the air and have, you know, to have themes to characters. And therefore, I controlled the rights. I controlled the publishing. And as a favor, since Howie Richmond to Larry Coleman, Howie Richmond were good enough to introduce me to Stan, who was representing, and the guy was my friend Bob Lawrence, who was really doing the producing. Stan Lee never did the producing. Marvel never was the producer of the Marvel superheroes.
Right.
It was Bob Lawrence. I said to them, the fair thing is that, Howie, you take the publishing, and you take the publishing for 28 years. At the end of 28 years, the publishing rights will revert back to me. He said, done.
Okay, so that's a key component to all this, because when you're coming in, that's part of the deal going in, that they're going to do, basically, so we understand it, they can do whatever they want with it, and they own it for that block of time. And then at the end of that block of time,
You're talking about the publisher, Howie.
Yeah, for the song. So they can take it, they can put it on the cartoons, they can put it on wherever they want. No.
What they can do, neither party, my deal was, you're getting this material, you cannot use it in any other project. On the other hand,
outside of the cartoons.
Outside of the cartoon.
Okay.
It can only be used in the cartoon.
Okay.
Now, on the other hand, as the owner of the publishing, Jack Arbont, and then licensing it to Howie Richmond under what was called the AGAC contract, which was for, that's how I learned about it. Harold Lawrence included me into that.
Okay.
Which was for the first copyright period of 28 years. And the thing called the master rights, which meant that you own the recordings, you own the master rights or the actual recordings. On the other hand, I would be foolish if I took my songs out of the TV series and stuck it somewhere else, though I had that right.
Mm-hmm.
Because why should I compete against myself?
At the time, like you could, if there was another cartoon or something Marvel wanted to do, you could have taken that and put it over there, but that wouldn't have made any sense.
Well, it with anybody.
Yeah.
It didn't have to be Marvel. It could be anybody. I owned it.
Okay.
And what I did was, have a verbal agreement for them to use it. They could not move it.
Okay.
They did infringe one thing, but I let it go. I also suggested doing it, you know, since my... Originally, I thought each episode was going to be for one character, like Thor, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was planning to write a relatively long theme, anywhere from 45 seconds, possibly a minute. And they changed their mind because, as I said, they were fighting among themselves. And they were fighting with their money man. And the whole project fell apart, by the way. In the middle of, while I was working, killing myself to get, you know, writing the stuff and orchestrating the stuff.
And this is the animation company you're talking about, the infighting with the animation company.
Infighting with the producers, Bob Lawrence,
right,
and Joe, I've forgotten his last name, Joe Harris.
Okay.
Friar Carr and Harris were Broadway producers, and Joe was the money man there. In fact, Joe's son wrote Spider-Man. That's how I did not get Spider-Man, because Joe's money was being pumped into it,
okay,
you know?
Okay.
At any rate, they were fighting among themselves, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was the production company, but I don't mean Marvel.
Right, right, right. Marvel's just saying, hey, yeah, we'd love you to do these things. Awesome. Here's some artwork. Go nuts.
Yes, exactly. Marvel was providing the, and as you know, my friends used to call it cheap animation, but that cheap animation is highly prevalent today. They took panels from the comic books.
Yeah.
And then shot them, and it became, and that's why the characters didn't move their lips or anything, you know? At any rate, so the year prior to that, I had recorded in London, doing Goodson and Todman themes for a production company. And I noticed the Brits were, to save money, I met George Martin, by the way, the producer of the Beatles things that year. And the following year, when the Marvel thing came up, I said, I noticed the Brits to save money. Americans to save money were going to Britain. The Brits to save money were going to Munich.
Okay.
So I had told them that, and a guy who was orchestrating for me on Mission Impossible, because I couldn't do it all because the episodes were coming so fast, a very lovely guy named Gus Donahue had a friend in Munich named Sam Spence, and he put me in touch with him, and I said, are you able to contract an orchestra for me and, you know, get me a fine studio? So he set me up with Bavaria soundstage, and that's how we did the music there.
And okay, and just so our listeners know too, a much different era back then, because it was mandated that music is performed by an orchestra for television at the time. Nowadays, you know, there's computers and they can put, you know, it can be a guy in a room putting
things
together. We talked to Blake Neely, who does all the shows in the Arrowverse. And it's like he just sits down and just starts cranking these things out like crazy. But at the time, back in the day, you guys had to have a full orchestra, was the mandate.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so
today,
much more involved process. That's why it was, yeah, you were so busy to crank these things out.
Yeah, and today you literally can improvise your score. You know, you can be a computer, you can improvise it right into the film.
Yeah, you don't have to get a full 70-piece orchestra coming in and pumping these things out. So yeah, just to give our listeners some background, a little bit different back in the day.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's where you're scoring. What was going on in Toronto? That was the voiceovers.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the voiceovers
were being done in Toronto.
Yeah. So what I did was record in Munich, mix the tracks in Munich. In those days, it was called compatible stereo. It wasn't real stereo, but it was what they called compatible stereo.
Right.
And I came back, and Bob Lawrence set up at the RCA Studios on Mechanic Street in Toronto, set up a session where we would record the voices. So I came up, supervised, and sang on all the tracks. In fact, I have a solo there on one of the tracks. I can't remember which character it was now.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
I did all my, you know, because I was a singer as well. I still do sing. I don't mean over the phone.
but we're glad you did.
So at any rate, we did the voices. I supervised that. And once again, not for Marvel, for Bob Lawrence. That's why this whole suit that I have,
We'll talk about that in a little bit, because that was a key part of this, was that you owning the rights and that they would revert back to you. Yeah, so we'll get into that in a little bit. But you're putting these things together. Let me pick your brain as far as the lyrics. We talked about Captain America, so you give us a little bit of background on that. What were you seeing? There's an overall Marvel superheroes theme. that kind of goes. So we've got, I mean, we've got the individuals.
Yeah, which was my suggestion, which is the Mary Marvel. I noticed that they use the phrase the Mary Marvel Marching Society. So I said to...
Where did you see that? Was that as you're flipping through the books and you saw that? Because that was sort of the club. That was like the kids club that they had. So
exactly. I saw it in the comics. I said there's a good idea for a song.
Okay.
The Mary Marvel Marching Society.
And what I like about it is you made it even cooler to be part of this club. Because you got to stand a little straighter, walk a little prouder, be an innovator, laugh a little louder.
You belong to the Mary Marvel Marching Society. March along to the song of the Mary Marvel Marching Society. That was it.
That was a cool kids theme back in the day.
Yep. And they made that and the Marvel Superheroes arrived. They made the Mary Marvel Marching Society the closing theme, and the Marvel Superheroes have arrived. The opening.
This one kind of encompassed all the, you know, you got the meet the sulky, over bulky, kind of hulky superheroes. Yes, you're kind of like introducing each one as they go through.
Exactly. And they thought it was a great idea, you know. I mean, I came up with that myself. I was going to write one longer theme for each episode. When they told me they're planning two or three characters per episode, they hadn't made up their mind yet. I said, okay, fine, I'll make it short enough so you can accommodate two or three characters, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why I set the actual length of each theme, you know?
Well, what I love about these two is that it's not only, you know, specific to each character. I mean, you're bringing out the best traits of each character, but there's almost like a style vibe with each one, because, you know, with the Hulk, you've got the, you know, the kind of crushing monster one, but then Iron Man, I think you've even referenced this. It's kind of like that Rat Pack, cool vibe swinging.
Well, exactly. Cause Tony Stark was a womanizer and a very cool cat in that respect. He was like a Sinatra character. And so I made the first half of that song, a kind of cool Sinatra kind of feel. And then when I got to the Iron Man section, I made it much more powerful and ponderous. So Tony Stark makes you feel he's a cool exec with the heart of steel. As Iron Man, all jets ablaze, he's fighting and smiting with repulsor ways, you know, et cetera.
I just love that dynamic between the two. And what's awesome is that it's even, they brought that into the movie.
Well, they licensed it from me.
Yeah.
They licensed.
Okay. That's what I wanted to check too. Just like everything's up above board on that, right? You got paid.
Absolutely. In fact, I have no problem with Marvel. I only had a problem with the rapper who stole my material and made it appear as if he'd written it. I have absolutely no problem. Marvel was on the up and up right down the line. I have a lot of respect for them.
Yeah.
And
no, it's very cool to hear that. It's Rhodey's ringtone. For those that don't know, if you're watching the first Iron Man movie, it's Rhodey's ringtone, right?
Oh, yes, the ringtone. Yes, it's his ringtone.
Yeah.
And not only his ringtone, there's a first section in the nightclub where they play the Iron Man theme, kind of a jazzed up Sinatra arrangement of it.
Oh, you know what? I don't know that I caught that one. I'm gonna have to go back.
It's right at the beginning of the film.
Okay.
And then that's how I discovered that this rapper had stolen my theme. I was getting calls. I wasn't personally getting calls, but the producer of the film, the assistant producer, said to me, "You know, we're getting calls from all over the world. You know, we got one from Shanghai today." And he said they're aware that this song was, that this Tony Stark theme that you've got in there was part of the cartoon series. And, you know, and they call it the classic cartoon theme. And I said, really? So I started looking it up on the internet. And sure enough, I noticed that there were people making comments about it. And then a number of months later, I looked it up again to see whether there are additional comments. And then there was a comment about this CD that was made and the Iron Man theme of the CD. So my wife brought it to my attention. She said, "I didn't know you had a CD with Iron Man theme." I said, "No, you're confusing it with the soundtrack CD."
Your wife didn't realize you were a rapper at night?
Well, she knew that I was wrapping presents, yes. She knew that.
For your anniversary.
That was the height of my wrapper, yes.
Yeah. Now, for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, there is, and I want to be careful because I know you have to be very careful about what you say. There's an ongoing lawsuit regarding this. It's Ghostface Killa is the rapper. I have no idea who it is. I do not listen to rap, but it's making headlines. It's kind of like an Iron Man Mandarin battle. You guys have been going back and forth for this for years. There's one judgment from him and Sony. There's another one for you. What can you tell us about where it's landed now? Because I know just a few weeks ago, as we record this, it kind of made some headlines again.
Yeah, the initial judge didn't know much about the music. I respect her a lot. She's a fine judge. I won't mention her name, but she made a very mistaken ruling that that the rights to the songs belong to Marvel, which is totally contradicted by the facts. And if Marvel owned the songs' rights, by the way, why did they license it from me?
They were saying it was considered a work for hire, because sometimes, you know, comic book artists or writers, or like even Stan Lee creates Spider-Man, but he doesn't own him. Marvel owns him. So it was kind of like thrown under that umbrella. Right.
But in fact, I was never hired by Marvel.
Right.
Marvel, as you know, Marvel never paid me a check.
Yeah, this was a whole different company, and they were like,
it was a whole company that went broke in a year.
Okay, so that's kind of been going back and forth in litigation.
Well, it was confusing to the judge because she was thinking of Marvel as the big, highly developed production entity. She thought of Marvel as the way we think of Paramount or MGM.
Right.
And she said they wouldn't give you the rights, you know. So that's why she ruled against me. But the lower court figured that out, and they recognized that I own the publishing rights, and there's still some ongoing things, so we'll have to go back into court.
That was the latest ruling, and we don't want you to go in too far because I know that is ongoing litigation. It's hilarious to me that the Iron Man theme from 50 years ago is still making headlines today. I love it. I mean, I don't love the fact that you're embroiled in a lawsuit, but it's amazing that this.
Yeah. It's a pain in the neck to be involved in a lawsuit, I assure you.
But for us fanboys and fangirls, we love that these are still relevant.
If I didn't own it, if Marvel owned it, why would they give me money to get the rights to use it?
Exactly.
Doesn't make sense.
Iron Man still making headlines to these days. I know with our time, I want to get to a couple of these other ones. But just even like The Submariner, very dramatic, but a character that... It was kind of like, I mean, we don't know a lot about him, but man, you just sort of took everything about him and brought it to life, brought it to the surface, no pun intended.
Right. And also the music for each character is like Submariner had music that almost felt like water flowing. You know, if you recall that video that you saw me do, I created a kind of watery sound in the music. And for Thor, I created a very majestic type of music, and as you know, for Tony Stark, it was a hip thing that then became a more powerful thing for Iron Man. So yes, each character I colored with respect to the music in relation to their character, as I did with, let's say, Lee Majors when he was on Mission Impossible, and he played a killer who had a fixation about killing women, prostitutes, that sort of thing. So I said to Bruce, I'm going to give you music on this thing that you will not believe. He said, what do you mean? I said, you'll see. I said, I'm going to give you a theme for Lee Majors that's a one-note theme. He said, what? I said, let's not talk about it. You'll see it. And what I had in mind is the Beethoven Symphony, that is a wonderful movement where the theme is bum, 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 bum. Bum 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 bum. It's a wonderful one note theme that Beethoven used. So I did the same thing, of course, not exactly Beethoven's theme, of course, but I used a one note theme because Lee Majors had a fixation. His fixation was to kill people who he thought were shady, women who he thought were shady, and that's what I did. The music had a fixation.
Wow.
And I remember the musicians, you know, they thought I was kind of nuts, you know, when I was recording it, because they're playing one note with all kinds of variations. And after the show aired, I remember some cello player saying to me, "Now I understand what you were doing," you know, when they saw the episode.
Well, we know how powerful just a few notes can be. I mean, we see Spielberg had the same reaction when Williams told him about Jaws until he heard it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he said, yeah, he just thought he was, yeah, really? That's it? and then it all, just two notes.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, my father, who toured with Sinatra, John Williams' brother was a percussionist.
Oh, wow.
My father knew John Williams. And John, when I was recording out at MGM, John heard one of my sessions, and I had a tremendous amount of respect for him, and I told him that my father had toured with his brother, and I think John's father was a percussionist as well. And I remember John said, "I'm impressed with your music." I said, "Well, I'm impressed with your Star Wars. Would you mind writing it out for me?" And he wrote his theme out and signed it.
Oh, man. Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, that's unbelievable.
He's a wonderful writer.
Well, these themes, I mean, again, like I mentioned, they're just part of the pop culture. They're part of these classic characters. They're part of the superhero universe. I got to ask you, and maybe you know about it, maybe you don't, and since you've given us the background on the rights, I was wondering if there, because we always talk about like these crazy cool things. We always talk about these, you know, really awesome superhero projects that aren't available on DVD. They're not available on Blu-ray. I know back in 2005, they had talked about releasing these on DVD. I know a couple of years later, they were released in the UK.
I'm told they are. Yeah, I don't have a copy of them, but I'm told there are DVDs on these.
They're kind of out there, but it's, like I said, they're Region 2 release in the UK. You really can't get them these days.
I see.
Okay, So you don't know whether or not that has anything to do with the music rights, or because I know sometimes you get into these projects, and a lot of times it's the music rights that are involved.
Not a lot of times.
Okay.
Legally, by law, you must get the right to put them out.
Okay. Does that have something to do with the fact that these aren't in a wide release right now?
I have no idea. Okay. In fact, if they, if I had to have a to threaten to sue New World Communications, which was owned by which bought Marvel, and which owned the rights to the TV series, and what they were doing was cutting the TV episodes up and selling them around the world as
back in the VHS days.
Yeah, as VHS packages.
Yeah.
They did not have the right to do that with my song. So I used a terrific attorney who had actually threatened to sue them on the Spider-Man thing.
Okay.
And the guy's name was Howard Gottbetter. I think Howard's still alive. He's an excellent attorney. And he handled the case for me. You know, they had violated my rights by putting out these video cassettes. And so they, then we worked out a fair settlement.
Okay.
I'm just kind of curious,
because we have an official release for the Spider-Man 67 series. I mean, that's been released. All those legalities have worked out. I know with the Batman show, I mean, there was a million legal hoops that they had to jump through, and 50 years later, we finally get the Batman 66 set.
But what I'm saying is, you know, just to bring this to a head, whenever an outfit, for instance, CBS put out DVDs on Mission Impossible, they had to come to me to get the rights for my music, even though they owned the publishing.
Okay.
They had to come to me to get the rights on The Lady Was Made to Be Loved, because I owned the rights on that song.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that, and that's always the thing, because these things were made back in the day before home video, and then nobody thought about that. And
exactly.
All of a sudden, you know, like WKRP in Cincinnati, I mean, there's tons of music rights that are involved in that, and they end up using like stock music for a lot of the DVD and stuff. Has any representative from Disney contacted you about the music for these Marvel superheroes as an official release?
Well, no. No one has ever contacted me about that. Why? Is the DVD coming out?
No, that's what we're curious about, because we haven't seen an official release, and I know they were always planning it. Like 10 years ago, they were planning it, and then it never came
to
fruition.
Fact,
so we're always kind of wondering, like, did they just not want to open up that can of worms?
No. Of course they're big enough. Disney is fine enough and big enough to do it. They called me, actually, many years ago. I don't know how many, maybe 8-10 years ago.
Okay.
Because they were planning to put something out, and they wanted to use my themes as a they used the expression dead under the announcer. I didn't know what they meant when they said dead. Mm-hmm. But then I subsequently found out. And at the same time, I was licensing my stuff to CBS. And CBS was, for the sake of argument, CBS was paying me, let's say, 10%, 10 cents, okay, for the rights to the songs that I had in Mission Impossible and Mannix, and the songs that I owned the rights to. And Disney offered me, let's say, 2 cents, you know?
Okay.
So I said to them, I'm using only that as an example, the pennies. So I said, well, CBS is paying me 10 cents, you know? And then they said, well, we're used to owning our own things. I said, well, I said...
that they are.
I said, well, I understand that. And not only that, I know why Walt Disney was used to owning it. Yeah. That was because when he was working for Paramount as a young fella, he drew characters and they owned the rights to it. He wanted to have the rights, and then he realized he has to own the rights. We have to grow up and learn these things, you know. We don't normally know these unless we've got some fine mentor, you know.
Now, that makes sense, because that may be the sticking point. I mean, I don't know for sure, but that seems like it might be a sticking point as to why these are released.
I doubt it. I think they're big enough to handle that.
You think Disney will come and make an offer you can't refuse?
I think, well, they have to, but I think they have to do that, but that couldn't be the only reason. Yeah. They wouldn't do this unless they thought they were going to make money on the sale of the thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
they did approach you about the movie Iron Man, so at least that's in their that's in their brain somewhere. Well, at least Marvel did, and then Disney bought out Marvel, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true.
Well, it's interesting, you know. I mean, we'd love to see them on DVD and Blu-ray. We'd love to hear them on official, you know, CD release or digital download. That'd be kind of awesome, too. So if that happens, you get the call, you let us know, right?
Absolutely, Joe.
So I know you're kind of stealth online. You fly under the radar a little bit. Is there any way online that we can find out the latest and greatest in the world of Jack Urbont?
Well, I think I mentioned to you that the reason I have kept myself being totally ignorant and idiotically ignorant about online and computers is because I spent so much of my life putting my behind down at the piano bench and writing. I did not want to spend another lifetime putting my behind down next to a computer.
I don't blame you.
So I kept myself away from it, mainly because it's really so totally encompassing and wonderfully encompassing. The internet is fantastic. I will ultimately get to it, okay? I promise you, before I hit 100.
Stan Lee's out there. He's out there online. We'll get Jack Urbont online. You get to hire a guy to come in and do that for you.
I guess I'm going to have to, Joe.
Get yourself an intern. Well, you got enough fans out there. We'd love to see you online and learn a little bit
I really should.
Last question. I'm going to put you on the spot real quick. You wrote an awesome poem to kick off this episode for Comic Book Central. If you're going to write a song about Comic Book Central or a jingle, how would you go about it?
First of all, I would get your cooperation, you know, because I assume that Comic Book Central is a phrase that you own or, you know, something that you own. So we would have to make a deal about that. I would own, you would have to make a deal with me about what I'm writing. And so we'd get our legality straight so that we don't have any bumps along the route. And whatever you wanted to tell me, I would put into the fabric of a lyric. And then if you wanted to change anything, you'd certainly feel free to bring it up or tell me I'm wrong about something. That would be the nature of the way it works.
My people would get with your people, right?
Yeah, but the best way to
can't blame
the
guy for trying.
The best way to do it always is to get the legality straightened out, you know, so that we don't stub our toes down.
I don't want you suing me. I don't want to be brought into court with Ghost.
Or you're suing me. You know,
I would never do that. Hey, I'm telling you what. I've had a crazy cool time catching up with you and chatting about these songs. They're part of my DNA since I was little. I'm sure I speak for many of the listeners out there as well. Thank you so much for putting these tunes in our brains. Thank you for so much music over the years. And thank you so much for joining me today on Comic Book Central.
Sure, Joe. I appreciate it. Can I mention one other thing?
Sure.
That in Canada, I did a show called The Littlest Hobo, which is a kind of like a Lassie. It was on the air for approximately 34 years. And I'm going to do my best to try to sell it to America again. So keep your eye out for that one. You'll get a big kick out of that show. I did not write the theme. It was written by a lovely guy up there in Toronto. But I did the background scoring for that show.
Very cool. We will look for it.
And the Emmy that I won was for Lauren Green's New Wilderness, and I did write the theme and the scoring for that show. So if you ever have a chance to see it, it's a terrific nature show. And my salutations and best regards to all your listeners. I think it's a great service you're doing, and I can't wait to listen to it. And I thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate it.
That is a heaping, helping of Broadway and Hollywood history right there, folks. Hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. And man, Jack needs to write a book. That would be an amazing book. I would definitely read it. Incredible stories, incredible career. For us comic book fans, Jack is a huge part of the history of Marvel Animation. And how about those original exclusive poems just for Comic Book Central? Man, that was awesome. Folks, this is where the cool things happen, just for you listeners of Comic Book Central. And really enjoyed Jack dropping some knowledge on me. I love learning stuff. I knew about the Rhodey ringtone in Iron Man, the first Iron Man film, but I totally missed the Iron Man theme in Caesar's Palace. I was watching what was going on. I didn't even catch it was on there at the start of the film. So, hey, gives me a good reason to go back and watch the film again, right? Always, you never really need a good reason to go back and watch Iron Man. It's a fantastic film. Now, as you may or may not know, there was a PBS documentary. It was called Superheroes, A Never-Ending Battle, that aired a few years back. It's available on Blu-ray and DVD. I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes on how to order it from Amazon. But one of the bonus features on the DVD and Blu-ray is Jack at his piano playing all the Marvel tunes. It is unbelievable stuff. That is really great. PBS also posted that clip on YouTube. I'll put that link in the show notes as well. Be sure to check it out. And don't worry, true believers, I did get permission from Jack to use the audio from the superhero themes on today's show. Don't want any litigation here in the lair, so that is taken care of. Huge thanks to Jack Arbon for joining us today and for giving us a behind-the-scenes glimpse at making Marvel musical history. That was fun. As I mentioned, links to the things you heard about on today's show, they can all be found in the show notes for this episode at my website. It's the online hub of the lair, comicbookcentral.net. You know where to go. There you are also going to find links to Comic Book Central on Facebook. Give the lair a like on social media. I'm posting some cool stuff out there. Terrificon stuff there. Also more coming up. Twitter, follow the show there at comicbookctrl. iTunes, subscribe to the show. You don't want to miss a moment of the actions coming your way. Much Terrificon goodness coming up. I can't tell you how much stuff's coming up. Please leave a review while you're in iTunes if you're there. If you're not in iTunes, Blueberry, Stitcher, the lair is everywhere. Go get you some each and every week. And I also want to hear what's on your mind. Drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can click that Signal Me tab on the website, comicbookcentral.net. All right, kids, that is it for today. Jack and I are off to go do some comic book karaoke, but fear not, I shall return, because next week on Comic Book Central, my adventure at Terrificon begins. So much headed your way. Oh, in the past, I have brought you two-part adventures. I can promise you even more this time. Putting it all together as we speak, I'm not sure how many episodes are going to be there. There's going to be a bunch headed your way. Stay tuned to Comic Book Central on Facebook and Twitter. You're going to be in the know when I know. I'll tell you how many episodes are coming your way on social media. I can tell you over the next few weeks, you're going to be hearing from these folks. Gotham's Cameron B. Condova, Sean Gunn, John Wesley Shipp, Sam Jones, Bob Camp, Rick Hoberg, Peter David, the comic book men, even more. They're all coming your way. It starts next week. Until then, keep singing those Marvel songs. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Imported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
We're going to let it ride.